from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. The racial integration of America's public schools began in earnest more than 60 years ago, and it is nowhere near finished. In the Bay Area, many schools partially desegregated, then resegregated, and are getting less diverse every year. The result? Children of color end up in worse schools, get worse grades, and go on to live worse lives. Why is this still happening? And what can we do to make it right? In this hour, we'll explore the problem, hear from parents and school district leaders, and take your questions and thoughts. School segregation today. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Quote, "In the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal." Unquote. Those were the words of Chief Justice Earl Warren in the decision of Brown versus Board of Education. That ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed school segregation and laid the foundation for integration efforts nationwide. And today, 61 years after that ruling, how far do you think we've come? By some accounts, we took more than 15 years to really get rolling with integrating schools, had just under 20 years of progress, then started rolling backwards in the late 80s, and we've been backsliding ever since. It may sound simplistic, but the statistics bear this out. Schools with mostly white and Asian children tend to perform better. Schools that are mostly black and Latino do worse, and the few where kids are truly integrated tend to have better performance overall. For everyone. Aren't we supposed to be past this by now? Decades after Jim Crow and Brown v. Board and the Little Rock Nine and Ruby Bridges and James Meredith, why are we failing this mission to integrate schools over and over? In this hour of Forum, we'll find out why. We'll get a clearer picture of what desegregation really involves and consider what we can do now to make good on the promise of education for all children. Joining me here in the studio for the hour is Antoine Wilson, the superintendent of the Oakland Unified School District. Superintendent, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also here in the studio is Jeremy Adam Smith. He's a reporter for the San Francisco Public Press, a nonprofit newspaper that recently reported on the link between school choice in town and resegregation. Jeremy, thanks for being with us this morning.
Great to be here.
And also with us on the phone is Nicole Hannah-Jones, an investigative reporter for the New York Times Magazine covering racial injustice. She's reported on school segregation for The Atlantic magazine and for a recent episode of This American Life. Nicole Hannah-Jones, welcome.
Thank you.
Antoine Wilson, let me start with you. Before we get deep into this topic, we should define what we mean by this term integration. I mean, I'm sure we all have an image of an integrated school, very diverse, hopefully harmonious, and so on. But technically speaking, how do we define an integrated school? Is it something we can measure?
Well, I think what you're looking for is a school that doesn't segregate students based on race or SES background, those types of things.
And socioeconomic status.
Socioeconomic status. And takes a concerted effort to try to expose students of different backgrounds to an education in the same space, same school. And you see them progress through the educational system together. I think that's it's an active effort to provide students access to a quality education.
Is this a particular ratio we're going for? This isn't the same as setting quotas, is it?
No, it's not a quota system. It's just, again, ensuring equal access to a quality education and taking steps to ensure that you don't have students' outcomes based upon racial or socioeconomic status fault lines. You don't want neighborhood to be a predictor of student success.
How integrated is Oakland Unified these days?
Well, I would say that it is our goal to be integrated. It's certainly our goal to provide students an equitable education. Oakland, like many urban cities, you see patterns that align in terms of our schools that align with what you see in our neighborhoods, which is tends to be a more segregated type of environment, and several schools that have a homogeneous populations, particularly based on race and class.
So it's somewhat segregated, kind of in line with the way that Oakland's neighborhoods break down racially. It's not quite as integrated as it could be.
It's not where we want it to be, not yet, but we are excited about our efforts to make it more so.
Let's continue talking about the background of all this. Nicole Hannah-Jones, first of all, kudos on an amazing piece on This American Life. That was very, very powerful, and if anyone hasn't heard it, they need to go back and listen to it. So first of all, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Before we talk about where schools are now nationwide, let's go back to Brown v. Board and kind of work our way forward. So the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that separate is inherently unequal, especially where public education is concerned. That meant a lot of places, including the Bay Area, had to deal with these old systems that kept black students and white students in very different school environments. That ruling was in 1954. And then what happened?
Well, what happened was the Supreme Court left it kind of up to school districts to determine when they would comply. It followed that ruling with Brown 2, which said they had to comply with the order with all deliberate speed. And what that basically meant to many school districts was very slow, if ever. So there was a period of massive resistance. Many southern states issued what they called the Southern Manifesto, where they promised that they would not comply with Brown. And so for years after Brown v. Board of Education, we actually saw very little desegregation occurring. You didn't see that picking up until the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, where the federal government could now withdraw funds from school districts that were not integrating. And then some Supreme Court rulings, particularly one in 1968, that said desegregation had to be real. You actually had to move students around. And then you began to see a pretty rapid desegregation between 1968 and 1988.
We mentioned the South. Was the West Coast, areas like the Bay Area and California, significantly different in how desegregation proceeded after Brown v. Board, or was it kind of the same nationwide?
Yeah, I mean, it was different in different regions of the country. The South had de jure segregation, which was segregation mandated by law. And so that was, at the beginning, it was very easy. You could go into a courtroom and show that the segregation had been mandated by law and get in order. In order to bring desegregation outside of the South, it was a bit more complicated because in many places it wasn't mandated by law, but segregation was a matter of policy, often housing and school policy. And so there were some later court rulings that allow for desegregation outside of the South. And that dealt with more de facto desegregation. And so that's what you began to see in parts of California. You saw it in, you know, the Midwest and the northeastern part of the country. But that has been really the most difficult segregation to fight, is that which was not written into law.
And briefly, where does desegregation stand today nationwide? Do we have any numbers on that?
What do you mean?
In terms of how, if there are numbers or reports on how well we stand right now, the snapshot of where America is at this moment with desegregation.
Well, Black students in this country are more segregated now than at any point since 1972. So we don't have the complete racial apartheid that you saw prior to Brown, but you do have levels of segregation very similar to kind of when you saw rapid desegregation in the 1970s. And what's worse, though, is that the segregation now is a double segregation. Black and brown students are segregated not only by race and ethnicity, but also by poverty. So they are in schools that are racially isolated and where almost every student is poor. And that has been shown to be very devastating on the learning environment.
Jeremy Adam Smith, you did some in-depth reporting on how San Francisco stacks up. How is the city doing in terms of school integration?
Well, on one level, it could be worse, but on another, it could be a lot better. We found that the number of racially isolated schools, those are schools with 60% or more of students from one racial group, had increased by about 22%. Now, we used a different calculation than the district. The district doesn't use the U.S. Census. It uses their own sort of customized standard that counts Filipinos separate from Asians. We just said, let's break it down: Blacks, Asians, Latinos, and whites. And, you know, we put the number of racially isolated schools at 39 as opposed to the district's 28 as a result of that.
So wait, let me back up for a second.
Mm-hmm,
you said that the number of racially isolated, more or less segregated schools in San Francisco has risen 22% over what span of time?
3 years.
22% in 3 years?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we find that today about 6 in 10 schools have majorities of one racial group. Now, what was most interesting to me is that if you went outside of school district data and if you looked at the city's children, what we found was that, you know, 43% of San Francisco is white, or at least it was a few years ago when we had census data. 33% of San Francisco's children are white, 12% of San Francisco's children go to public school, white children go to public schools. So there are huge numbers of white children who are not attending public schools. And when we really drilled down on the data, when we looked at the neighborhoods, when we looked at the district, what we found was that the district itself was becoming racially and economically isolated from the city as a whole.
What would you say are the main one or two factors behind that?
The answer is money and measurable white supremacy.
That's a very loaded term.
Yes, it is.
Measurable white supremacy. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, the listeners can't see me, but I'm white. And thus I feel empowered to say this. White supremacy is not a figment of our imaginations. It's a measurable reality. And you can see it in, for example, income discrepancies. You know, as of a few years ago, when we have the most recent data available, whites made 3 times more money than the average black resident. Whites made 66% more money than the average Latino resident and 44% more than Asians. So that is white supremacy at work. That is the color hierarchy at work. And that is part of what shapes the landscape of schooling in San Francisco. And it shapes the achievement gaps that preoccupy us so much. And it feeds into all different dimensions of our society. It feeds into incarceration rates. It feeds into, you know, who has access to political power and who doesn't. And anybody who thinks otherwise, I really think, needs to do some work.
And so you're talking about white parents having more economic freedom to, say, send their kids to parochial schools or to private schools instead of sending them to the public school system.
That is absolutely correct. That is exactly what I'm saying.
I'm sure we're going to get plenty of interesting comments about about white supremacy, racial supremacy in as it relates to education.
I'm happy to take them.
I'm sure. But I take your point in terms of the legacy economic issues that maybe are now playing out. So we're discussing school segregation in the 21st century with Oakland Unified School Superintendent Antoine Wilson, Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times Magazine, and Jeremy Adam Smith of the San Francisco Public Press. And we need to hear from you. How has school integration, or maybe the lack thereof, affected your child? First day of school back at SF Unified. Maybe this is something that's on your mind. What's happened in the past? What could be done better for the future? If you're a student, what has it been like for you dealing with issues of diversity on campus? And of course, to anybody, what should we do about all this? We welcome your questions, your ideas, and your personal stories. So call us. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. 6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Before we get to the phones and to your feedback, let's talk to one parent who has dealt with some of these conversations. Galen Anderson is a member of the Parents Advisory Council of the San Francisco Unified School District. Galen, good morning.
Good morning.
So how much, if at all, does campus diversity factor into the decisions of the parents that you've encountered about where to seek slots for their child? Is this an issue that ranks in terms of priorities for the parents you encounter?
Oh, for sure. We held these racial community conversations, and I'm going to tell you that it plays a big part, because when you have parents that have a higher tax bracket, they tend to send their students to high-performing schools, whereas in the lower income, like into the Bayview, they don't get the resources that they need, such as experienced teachers with expertise, transportation that's available, schools that have resources, you know. And so, yeah, it plays a big part. Diversity plays a big part in San Francisco Unified School District. You know, African-American achievement and leadership.
You mean campuses that have African-American principals, teachers, administrators that are visible on campus?
Yeah. You know, people respond to people that look more like themselves.
This is also, I imagine, in San Francisco in particular, about much more than just black-white. You know, there is a significant Latino population here. There's a very significant population from the Asian diaspora here. How does that maybe complicate things in terms of having this conversation specifically in San Francisco?
Well, I think it complicates it because of the economic and racial situation that these parents are facing. You know, you can go so many years without the resources that are available, and then it becomes, you know, kind of a way of life for some of these parents, you know. So it's something that we need to change.
So some parents just kind of get used to saying, well, this is what I got, and this is what I'm kind of always going to have?
Well, exactly.
What has the Parents Advisory Council done to try to address these issues of racial integration on campus? You'd mentioned that there was a series of kind of town hall meetings where people could discuss it. Any other initiatives or maybe major recommendations to the school board?
Well, absolutely. We played a part in the LCAP, you know, trying to get certain initiatives passed with the school board. We hold these racial conversations in many schools, not just elementary, but middle schools and high schools. And we go out and we get this information from the parents and we present it to the school boards.
How much power do parents actually have in driving the racial composition of these schools from the perspective of pushing the school board to do different things? In your experience, and I know you're not speaking for all parents, but in your experience, how receptive has the school board been to these issues, really?
Oh, they've been very receptive to the parent voice. You know, parent voice is very big in the San Francisco Unified School District. It's just that when are some of these things going to be taken into account? That's the big issue. You know, they are very receptive to it. We've gone out and held many community conversations.
And before we move on, Galen, for you, if you could put one measure, one action on the agenda of the SF Unified School Board that you know that they would move on or act on or at least take seriously, one thing they could do to make an impact on this, what would you put on the agenda?
What I would put on the agenda is to try to reverse racial isolation, because that's one of the biggest things that is taking place today. We don't have teachers that are experienced. We don't have teachers with expertise. We don't have transportation. You know, it would be good if we could get a magnet school in the baby on the elementary level, you know, so that some of the initiatives that the school board has put out can be met by all these different bodies, by these state-of-the-art magnet schools.
Right, right. So specific kinds of educational environments that would have to be basically built from the ground up to attract students.
Yes, like Willie Brown. Like Willie Brown is one of them.
Right, the school that's reopening today.
Excuse me?
The school that's reopening today, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. If we could have a state-of-the-art magnet schools on the elementary level, that would be so supportive to the initiatives, you know, such as the 2025 vision, you know, student profile, African American achievement and leadership, you
right.
know, and of course the success of Willie Brown.
Gotcha. Galen Anderson is a member of the Parents Advisory Council of the San Francisco Unified School District. Galen, thanks very much for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to get to calls and emails in just a moment, but Superintendent Antoine Wilson from Oakland Unified, I wonder what you, granted, Galen Anderson is a parent in a different district, but some of the things that she brought up are ideas that have been done before. I mean, I went to a magnet high school. I'm from South Florida, and my school was incredibly diverse. It was kind of this United Nations campus because kids came from everywhere and wanted to be at that school. I guess I would have thought, naively, that that's the way a lot of schools would go because we know that works. Has that been your experience on the ground in Oakland, previous districts you've been at? What's it actually been like from the administration point of view?
Well, thank you. You know, I think there were definitely some really good points made there. Magnet schools definitely are one part of the solution. Now, when you talk about magnet schools, what you're talking about is providing some schools a disproportionate amount of resource in order to achieve integration in order to increase access to schools for other, for certain groups of students. And taking those types of actions in some places becomes somewhat controversial, because what you're saying is that you're going to give some students more than you give others. And so I think it's appropriate. In Oakland, what we're saying is, you know, equity is extremely important. We are engaged and excited. We are kicking off an equity policy discussion and discussions all over the city about this particular issue, because we believe it is important to say that some students need more. Therefore, some students will get more. And that means putting programs in parts of the city in order to attract other students, but also in order to keep students in their neighborhood and those cities from feeling they need to leave the district as well.
Gotcha. Let's dive in on the phones now before we come up on a break. 866-733-6786, beginning with Ashley in San Jose. Ashley, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. So I did grow up in a racially segregated hometown, if you will. We had two different main counties. I'm actually from out of state. And we did have this problem. My mother actually was the first generation to be bused to mixed schools, so it's very close to hometown. And what my area did was, firstly, they did set up a new school, despite the fact that we didn't have the population need for it yet. Then they re-gerrymandered the lines. But despite re-gerrymandering the lines, there was still a little bit of that racial segregation, because you can't change where people live. Primarily, you've got a lot of Caucasian people who are living in a gated community or their own community, and then you have the African Americans living in another community. It's just really hard to jump from one place to another without having a real reason to.
Right.
So what they did was, my school allowed students across the county line to attend other schools. So usually you can only attend within your county.
Right. Now, well, by the way, what part of the country were you in?
Georgia.
Okay. All right. That seems like a pretty – and Ashley, I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you very much for calling in. We're coming up on a break, and I would like to hear the rest of your story, but we're almost out of time for this segment. I did want to put that to Nicole Hannah-Jones for a second. We're coming up on a break, but this sounds familiar to what you covered in your This American Life segment, right, in terms of busing and the impact of that today.
Right. I mean, I think – one, we tend to use neighborhood segregation as an excuse not to do anything. And neighborhoods are very segregated, and I've also written about the lack of fair housing enforcement, which would lead to more integrated neighborhoods. But there certainly are ways to integrate schools and school districts. Often in the South, a school district is a county-wide district, which allows for more integration. But you can draw attendance zones that would include a white neighborhood and a black neighborhood, and they would feed into the same school.
And actually, the report you did on This American Life dealt with the school district where Michael Brown went to school, the young man who was shot in Ferguson. We're going to play a piece of that report on the other side of this break as we continue our conversation about school segregation in the 21st century. We're speaking with Oakland Unified School Superintendent Antoine Wilson, Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times Magazine, and Jeremy Adam Smith of the San Francisco Public Press. Please feel free to keep calling in on the phones, 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you today. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're continuing our conversation on school segregation in the 21st century with Oakland Unified School Superintendent Antoine Wilson, Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times Magazine, and Jeremy Adam Smith of the San Francisco Public Press. And we want to hear from you. Call us, 866-733-6786. Phone lines are jammed up right now, so your best bet is probably to email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also post your comments online. Go to kqed.org/forum. Jeremy Adam Smith, you wanted to chime in before we had to go take a break.
Well, I wanted to make a point about busing. The period of forced or integration busing was a tactic that was designed to deal with explicit racism that was enforced by law. And that's something we have to keep in mind. And again, you know, this is historical fact. This is not a figment of anybody's imagination. You know, it was not very long ago that the races were kept separate literally at the point of a gun. So that was the legacy that's the legacy that we're dealing with, and that is the problem that integration busing was designed to address. A lot of the problems that we have now with racial segregation have to do with implicit bias. Implicit bias is not racism. Implicit bias is it's evidence of our subconscious minds at work that in ways that sometimes contradict our conscious values. So I absolutely believe my fellow white people when they say they're not racist or they don't want to be racist or they've never discriminated against anybody consciously. But in our report, when we looked at widespread racial segregation in the city of San Francisco, I really think that what we were doing was uncovering evidence of that implicit bias at work, of groups of people sorting each other based on, you know, like going to like, and not really being very aware of it. And so I think, and we'll talk more about solutions later, that today we're really talking about ways to correct for that implicit bias, that subconscious bias. And I think part of that is respecting people's values and where they say they're coming from. But I also think it means helping people to become aware of their own biases and encouraging them to make different decisions.
That's actually a good transition to the clip I wanted to play from This American Life. And Nicole Hannah-Jones, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this on the other side. Basically, the show was called The Problem We All Live With. We'll be linking to it from our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can also find it on This American Life's website. Nicole, you reported on a failing school district near Ferguson, Missouri, which is where Michael Brown went to school. He graduated just weeks before he was shot dead. In this scene that we're going to play, there's a town hall meeting taking place among parents of a mostly white school district where kids from Brown's district, which is mostly black, would soon be basically bussed to help them get a better education. This was just 2 years ago. And the parents in that mostly white district were not happy about it, particularly because the state law gave them no real say in the matter. Here are some of the parents airing their concerns.
My question is, when a child who is coming from an underperforming school with low test scores comes into a math class at Francis Howe, how will they ever possibly cope?
Once Normandy comes in here, will that lower our accreditation?
That was the reaction from some of the white parents. And then one of the African-American students, Mariah Martin, expressed what she wished she had had a chance to tell them.
What if your kid was in Normandy High School and they were just offered this opportunity, and other parents are saying, we don't want you here. How are you going to feel? We're just stuck there because we're not open to the opportunities. And now we're open to them, and now you want to be all mean talking about you're afraid how big the class is going to be, the violence in the schools. And
that was a clip from This American Life. Nicole, what did you make of those concerns the parents expressed and of Mariah's reaction?
Well, I think, one, I'd like to push back a little bit on that most, you know, a lot of the segregation has to do with implicit bias. Two things. I think intent doesn't really matter. I think the results matter. But also, much of my work is about showing the way that segregation is intentionally created. If you hear those parents, they're not saying anything about race, but the racial implications are very clear in what they're saying. And when you look at the way that school districts draw school attendance zone lines, they are obviously taking into consideration the race of communities that they're drawing around. They're heavily gerrymandered, and they're producing very certain results. And a great deal of this segregation, as I said before, has to do with housing segregation, which data shows is rampant, and that is intentional discrimination. So I think that we should just not, you know, we should not focus so much on whether people are intentionally being racist or not, but what are their actions and who's being harmed. And you can look at the case of Maria. I don't think it really matters whether those parents say anything specifically racist or not. They clearly did not want the children in this black school district to come into their community, which was almost all white, and that was very devastating to Maria.
Let's get to a couple of your comments. Michelle wrote us on Facebook, having gone to school in Vallejo, diversity is incredibly important to me. The lessons are invaluable. and having gone to school in Vallejo and barely learning anything at school, I'm looking a lot at school performance when choosing schools for my own kids. The research suggests integration not only creates diversity, but also improves academic outcomes. Let's do it. Rebecca writes on Facebook, there's a huge problem of segregation within schools. 10 years ago, I worked for a national educational program. I was charged to increase diversity in advanced placement and college prep courses in California schools. More often than not, many schools with more than 50% Latino students had zero students in AP courses. Most were being tracked out by white old school counselors and teachers. The AP classes were primarily, if not exclusively, white and Asian. Let's continue now on the phones with James in San Francisco. James, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Sorry, this kind of goes back a little ways. I've kind of been on the line for a while, but commenting on the measurable white supremacy. I mean, aside from the questionable syntax there, but just the reaction of white and Asian parents to send their children to private schools instead of the public schools. I mean, of course, there'd have to be proof of causality that the integration is what's causing that. But does that point to the more natural solution being maybe affirmative action at even the grade school levels? And I'm just curious about the landscape. Is anybody talking about that? Is anybody resisting that? I'll take my comments up there. Thank you.
Thanks, James. Good question. Jeremy?
Well, so I think that let's talk a little bit more about implicit bias, because Nicole was pushing back against that. And I actually think that speaks to the gentleman's question as well. It's absolutely true that there is racism out there, and it hasn't gone away. And I think currently the national spokesperson for the explicitly racist position in America is Donald Trump. And so we can't for a moment let down our guard in fighting against that. It exists. It's real. And it's an issue. And it drives a lot of segregation. What I'm really talking about are people who want their children to grow up in a multiracial environment, who want their children to be comfortable with diversity, and yet find themselves struggling to actually pull the trigger on implementing those values in their actual lives. And to me, that's really the front line right now, is trying to wage that battle. And, you know, earlier you asked the question, you know, why are we failing on this mission to integrate schools? We've been trying for so long. And, you know, the answer is that we gave up. We gave up on that mission. The courts withdrew their integration orders. Numerous judges
in San Francisco, you mean?
In San Francisco, but also elsewhere. And by the way, this is also an important point to make. In a San Francisco context, a lot of the fights for school integration were actually led by Chinese Americans. If you go back and you look at the actual history, going back to the 19th century, it was Chinese Americans who were suing to get access to all-white schools. It's really an alternative civil rights paradigm. And then later in the 60s, it became much more about that black-white dynamic. But that's still something that, you know, shapes the San Francisco context and I think makes it a little bit unusual. And the other thing that's unusual here is that really, everybody in this community is explicitly committed to, you know, nobody's in favor of racism. Nobody wants to be a racist. And yet racism persists. You know, it is still the case that white people benefit from a system that gives them disproportionate privileges and advantages.
And I think maybe that's where the terminology becomes an issue, where you're referring to the aftermath of these legacy systems that were based on racism.
Right, right.
That still have ripple effects and that still reverberate today and are manifesting themselves, even though the ideology is no longer at all socially acceptable.
I wish it were simple, but it's not. It's complex. There's a lot of contradictory things happening and people have different feelings. And sometimes they can feel really personally offended by these issues.
I hear that. Eric writes this via email for you, Superintendent Wilson. We know that you were not superintendent when the decision was made, but why was underperforming school attendance eliminated as the school assignment priority? This appears to us to be a step in the direction of segregation and not away from it.
Well, the caller is certainly correct in terms of me not being there when those decisions were made. You know, what I would say is, you know, for us in Oakland, what we see happening is really a major issue beginning in middle school. Certainly the elementaries reflect, and like most elementaries across the country, neighborhood patterns, but we have students who are willing to travel in Oakland. But in middle school, across racial groups, we see a significant decline in enrollment in our public schools.
And overall,
for every racial group, we see it. And it's based strictly on class. And middle and upper SES families, they tend to choose to go elsewhere. And in families who do not have means to go elsewhere, they tend to stay in Oakland. Now, that has an impact on our schools in terms of student enrollment. And what ends up happening is we have this interesting issue where when we begin to force families to zone into a particular school, then they tend to exercise that right even more. So the solutions for us are not as simple solutions. For us, what we've decided to do is what we said is we have to make sure that some of those schools that are highly impacted, so one of the callers talked about AP, we have to make sure that, one, we have gotten rid of some of the institutional barriers that have been put in to maintain the impact of racism. So regardless of how people feel, prerequisites to classes that don't require prerequisites, counselor recommendations for opportunities. And you hear the young lady speaking about some of the opportunities she wants and some of the feelings that persist when she wants to go to a school, and just taking those head on. And that's the way we're approaching it, is we got to make sure that our schools, particularly at our secondary schools, that they have access to programs that they otherwise would not get, regardless of the student makeup of the school.
Let's continue on the phones now with Sarah in San Francisco. Sarah, good morning.
Oh, yes. Hi, good morning. I just had a comment. So I grew up in San Francisco, and we grew up first in the Haight and then over kind of the Glen Park area. And my parents decided to send us to private school, starting in kindergarten all the way through. And then our public school was Balboa, and they didn't want us to go there, so we ended up in private school, both my sister and I. And I really think that it didn't serve us. Really, really not diverse. And actually, my family doesn't have, you know, I mean, we're middle class, but going to school with some of the wealthiest kids in San Francisco. So not only did that not serve us, but just the lack of diversity. I think it's kind of gone through my whole life with the implicit bias that we've all been talking about. And I was going to say this might be an opportunity for some of the private schools in the Bay Area to look at maybe kind of diversifying, because it really serves the kids in the future. So that was my comment.
I hear you. Sarah, thanks for calling in and sharing that. That kind of echoes one of the email comments that we got. Rebecca in Oakland, who's a mother of two, wrote, "What I often miss in these conversations," and I hope we're making this point, by the way, she writes, "What I often miss in these conversations is the point that integrating schools is better for everyone, yes, not just for minorities. Diversity creates better learning and better outcomes. Look at all the research about the workplace that proves exactly this point." Nicole Hannah-Jones, that was one of the points that you made in your report on this American Life, wasn't it? That when schools are truly integrated, it really is a rising tide that lifts all boats. Everyone does better.
Yes. I mean, the data and the research shows that not only are white children not harmed by integration, but that they are benefited in the long term. But I think the problem is, largely in this country, segregation has benefited white Americans, and it has not. It has harmed black Americans and also brown Americans. And so you have a situation in most communities where if white students don't go to an integrated school, they're still going to get a quality education. But for black and brown children, that's often not the case. And so how do you then incentivize people for whom have choice, have resources, can decide they're going to invest in public schools or not, to remain in schools when a lot of times parents do not understand the benefits for their children?
Jeremy?
I think incentives are absolutely key, and I think that that's where the San Francisco School Board has been going. You know, for example, I spent a lot of time in my article talking about the placement of language programs in the city. Historically in San Francisco, language programs have actually driven segregation. And the reason for that is very simple. We have a lot of immigrants in the city, and the school board was creating language pathways for those kids so that they could begin bridging cultures. However, recently, the school board has actually started strategically placing programs to make the schools more integrated. And the big success story here in the district is Star King Elementary, which used to be one of the most segregated schools in the city, predominantly black, and is now the most racially balanced. It's roughly one quarter for each major racial group. And the reason for that is the placement of a Mandarin language immersion program. And, you know, and those kids are in different programs, the general ed and the Mandarin immersion. They're in different programs, but they mix in numerous classes on the field. And I hope, I've heard from parents, and this has waxed and waned over the years, that the administration will try to bring the groups together a lot. And some parents I interviewed told me, if you take the initiative, you can cross racial lines at that school. And I think that at the very least, school like Star King creates the opportunity to do that, which a lot of parents don't have.
Let me get to a few more online comments. Anna writes, I have been a student of the SFUSD school district from K through 12. Children were given priority to their neighborhood school. Although we all want our children to have short commutes to school, assigning schools based on neighborhood racially segregated the schools. There was a disparity between the Asian-dominated west side of San Francisco and the primarily African-American and Latino east side. I believe that racially integrating schools is important and that SFUSD should note this source of inequality. Matt writes, the vast diversity at my daughter's school is a huge asset for her in this era. She doesn't think twice about someone's race, but rather about the person. Sadly, there are almost no black students at her school in Cupertino, and very few Latino students, and I'm left to wonder and speculate as to why. Income? Housing costs? Educational opportunities? I don't know the reasons, but it is clearly a divide, as we have Indian, Asian, European students, so many cultures and so many differences that strengthen our community. Back to the phones now with Clarence in Oakland. Clarence, good morning.
Good morning. I was calling to make a comment. Me and my family just moved from Atlanta, Georgia to Oakland in the Laurel District, and we live about a block away from Laurel Elementary and about two blocks away from Redwood Heights Elementary. Yet, for the last 2 years, our daughter keeps getting zoned to Carl B. Monk Elementary. We're African American, and when we looked at the three schools, it's very apparent that Carl B. Monk is specifically zoned for African-American kids, whereas Redwood Heights is for white kids, and the Laurel Elementary is for Asian kids. And we just kept thinking it was real peculiar that for some reason we just keep getting zoned to Carl B. Monk. And it almost comes off like the Bay Area is more segregated than back home in the South.
Clarence, I hear you on that. Thank you for calling in. Superintendent, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that what the caller is speaking to is something that we recognize needs to be addressed in our district. It's one of the reasons why we're looking this year at updating our school assignment policy. Really what it comes down to is just, you know, we have two preferences. One is based on siblings being in the school, and the other is based on neighborhood. And then it reverts to a lottery. And so in the cases of the schools that were mentioned, you will have students who have siblings in the school. They'll get preference, other neighborhood students, and then it ends up working out that way. Carl B. Monk is a school in the Slopes area, and it's an area where you have a lot of students in our heartland areas who will want to go up to those schools. And so you tend to see that segregation. We are noticing those patterns, and it's one of the reasons why we've opening up conversations this school year to address our enrollment policies. Lastly, though, I do want to say this. It's one of the reasons also why we're pursuing certain opportunities in some of those schools like Carl B. Monk, such as International Baccalaureate and other types of programs that we think will help attract a more a diverse group of students into schools like Carl B. Monk.
My school was an IB school. I was the IB diploma graduate, actually, which I think was a large reason why I went to a school that was like 43% white, 33% black, and I forget the balances of Asian and Hispanic, but clearly that was one of those really strong reasons why people were willing to bus from all over the county to go to my high school. By the way, Superintendent, are you getting enough support from the state and the federal government to make this happen?
Well, you know, I think I would say that, you know, government agencies could be a lot more helpful. It relates to this. I mean, I think the state, looking at what it's doing with the local control funding formula, that I find that helpful, particularly for cities like ourselves, because it's recognizing that some students do need more resource. But I also believe that it's really important to think about, given the circumstances that we find ourselves in terms of neighborhood patterns and so on and so forth, how do we broaden this conversation beyond just what the school system can do and look at what we can do to incent more housing and integrated housing in our cities and counties throughout the country. Finally, when we look at education policy, one of the things that I'm really interested in is how we expand time in school. So that, and you and I, most people talk about time, they're thinking about how you can give kids more access to reading, writing, math, so on and so forth. What I'm really thinking about is one of the benefits of middle-class education is exposure to experiences. And so how do we make sure that students have enough time in school so that the school can think about and contemplate ways that they can expose students to experiences they might not otherwise get the benefit from if they're not in a school that's integrated?
It's interesting that you mentioned the lottery process in Oakland. We got a Facebook note from a parent who was in San Francisco. Jim writes, "The school assignment process is severely broken. I very badly wanted my 5-year-old to attend SF Public School because diversity is important to us. But the school lottery system forced me and my family to move after 15 years of residence in SF. The assignments are not random, difficult to navigate with multiple rounds that frustrate parents and increase traffic across the city from parents shuttling their kids to schools clear across town. The end result is that after months of debate between my wife and me, we moved out of the city. This is a yearly phenomenon that is nothing new and feeds the current segregation issues of San Francisco." Back to the phones now with Allie in San Francisco. Allie, good morning.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. Thanks for taking me.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, my name's Allie Collins. I'm a parent, but I've also been an SFUSD educator and an educator in Oakland. I've worked as an ed consultant. And what I see is that parents want to blame the school district, and they want to blame, like, society and housing, and those are definitely issues that need to be addressed. But what parents don't want to acknowledge is their own racism. And I've heard multiple parents saying they don't want to send their kids to a neighborhood school because there's, quote, too many project kids, or there's too many Mandarin, you know, Chinese-speaking kids. And they'll say this to me on the side, and, they'll, you know, it's basically, I think I live in Russian Hill area. It's very diverse here. And there's most of my neighbors that send their kids to Catholic schools because they didn't get into schools that were had enough white kids. And I think we need to start a conversation among parents about whether we really value diversity and whether white parents are willing to actually be the diversity at the school.
Gotcha. Allie, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts. We're running out of time for the hour, and I do want to talk solutions in just a second. But let me get to one more call, at least one more call, from Donna in Nashville. Donna, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This was mentioned a little bit earlier. But I do like the word integration over desegregation because integration focuses on quality of life. But I think a neglected topic thus far has been within school segregation, specifically using tracking and gifted and AP classes to have a private school within a public school. And it's been my experience after 20 years in gifted education that superintendents and school boards will not touch gifted and AP classes, meaning they will not desegregate or integrate that, or else there will be white flight and green flight. But I like to have more attention to this because we do have an extremely large number of Black and Hispanic students who don't have access to those classes. And so we could, segregation continues in gifted and AP classes.
Hey, Donna, that's a good point. Thank you for calling in with that. Nicole Hannah-Jones, can you speak to that briefly in terms of those gifted AP, IB elite classes?
Absolutely. I mean, that is segregation 2.0. And where you don't see big achievement gains in integrated school buildings, it's because there's a great deal of tracking within the building. So when we're talking about integration or desegregation, we're talking about down to the classroom level. Unfortunately, what you find, even with magnet programs, is that they will have diversity within the building, but then in order to keep those white parents in the school and happy, then those students will be placed in their own classes by themselves. And that's a big problem.
Let's go to one more phone call, and then we'll start talking solutions. We got to wrap up. Eileen in East Palo Alto. Eileen, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to hear this conversation. I wanted to talk about my experience growing up in Mississippi. I was in Mississippi Public Schools the year that, in the middle of the year, they were finally desegregated. So I had the great privilege of going to integrated public schools from first through 12th grade. And I feel like I benefited so much from that experience, not only then, but actually throughout my life. I benefited. I could especially see this in college when I was in college with folks who had gone to segregation academies and had not had the privilege of learning from African American or other people of color. Mm-hmm. Their worldview was somewhat, it was just so impoverished. They could not, they had difficulty seeing things from different perspectives. That I felt like I was able to do because of my experience.
Right.
So I felt incredibly privileged by that. Also, I'm not as afraid of encountering people who are different from me as I have seen others who grew up in a very white-only environment. I see a lot more fear in them.
Right. Hey, Eileen, I'm sorry. I hate to cut you short. We're running out of time in the hour. I appreciate you calling in. Superintendent Wilson, very, very briefly, I'm going to give you the last word. What's the one best thing that the state can help you do, that the school board can help you do at Oakland Unified to help close this gap, very briefly?
Well, one, I think that the state could take efforts to ensure equal access to schools regardless of governance type. So whether you're a district-run school or charter school, I think that's an important issue. There are certain advantages charter schools have. District-run schools do not. It makes it more challenging. I also think that in terms of just in general families, it is providing them access to funds and continuing to ensure that students who need more get more.
That's Superintendent Antoine Wilson of Oakland Unified School District, reporter Jeremy Adams Smith of the San Francisco Public Press, and Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times Magazine. Thank you all for being with us this hour. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, Vinnie Tong, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Please keep the conversation going online at kqed.org/forum. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening and have a great school year. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.